Thursday, January 24, 2008 session of the House Interim Committee on Government Accountability and Information Technology to order. Welcome, everybody. As I was saying earlier, you're going to see more and more, I think, laptops up here at the dais starting now, especially since we don't really have a place to sit. We have no office, so it's going to be an interesting little session in that way. I've got two pieces of informational meeting that I'm going to do. I'm going to have Lindsay Ball, who's the new director of Oregon Wireless Interoperability Network work group, and it's more than a work group, do some update on Owen. And then Carla Filsinger will give us an update on plain language. So with that, I'm going to open this informational meeting. And Lindsay, take it away.
Mr. Chair and members of the committee, my name is Lindsay Ball. I'm assigned to the governor's office to be the director of the Oregon Wireless Interoperability Network project. Thank you for this opportunity. And one of the things that I've learned in the last month and a half that I've been assigned to this task is that there's a lot of misunderstanding, a lot of misinformation, and hopefully today we can start to clear some of that up. And then I also I hope I can impart to you the status of Oregon, federal mandates that we're looking at, and how we might be able to pair some of the cost associated with the project. The front page that you have in front of you that shows a mountaintop and a tower off on the right-hand side, I put that in for a purpose. Now, I want you to start thinking about how radio waves work. Line of sight, for the most part, they don't bend well. So you have to use a high mountain sight to be able to transmit from or reach from a car or a handheld to a mountain sight to be able to then move in a network around the state. And Oregon is a large state, 11th in size compared to the other states in the U.S. It is extremely geographically diverse. We've got several mountain ranges in the state. We have several watersheds throughout the state that create problems and barriers for radio communication, because a mountain or a canyon becomes a barrier for that radio wave, and therefore you have to then put in another site to be able to transmit from that location into a blind spot, so to speak, after having after being obstructed by that physical barrier. The topics I want to cover with you today are the federal mandates that are coming down upon us from the Federal Communications Commission, the status of Oregon state-owned communications, proposed consolidation of four state radio systems into one, public safety technology trends, and a comparative cost to the seven Northwest counties that will give you an idea of where we're headed with respect to cost. Now, this all comes back around to what happens if we don't do anything with Owen today, with our radio system that we have. There's a greater opportunity for system failure, which may lead to the public not receiving timely and critical services due to lack of communications. There could be a loss of federal funds due to non-compliance of federal mandates that are being imposed upon all the states in the U.S. Failure to give public safety personnel available tools for productive and safe operations. Extended outages due to lack of spare parts. Everyone wonders, well, what do you mean by extended outages due to lack of spare parts? The system that we have today in the state of Oregon is so outdated that we actually surf eBay to look for used and spare parts that we can buy to keep this system running that we have currently. no one manufactures those parts anymore. That's how outdated we are in many instances. Not in all, but in many instances where the backbone of that communication system rests upon that age-old technology. Higher risk of no communications during a critical event, limited operability and interoperability, increased operations maintenance expense, and currently today we're maintaining four systems versus one. Now on the fourth slide, to kind of give people a perspective of conditions and situations that you find your communication system in, I put a picture in of a tower that's loaded with ice. It's on a high mountaintop. They are subjected to severe weather conditions. They are set at a standard for 100 to withstand a wind speed of 150 miles an hour. With a fully loaded tower with all the dishes, antennas on it, that tower, by federal standards, cannot twist more than 1 degree. And to give you a point of reference to that, the microwave beam that is emitted from that tower is 1.4 degrees. So it has to stay that rigid in order to make sure that that communication link isn't broken. Because if it wobbles too far, it breaks that beam width, and then you lose connection and communication. Slide 5 illustrates a snow cat coming up to a radio house up on top of a mountain. When things are in need of repair, it's not always in 90-degree weather in the middle of summer. You have to access the site by snow cat. Then if you take a look at slide 6, you'll see where you actually dig into the radio house on top of a mountain through the snow to be able to get to the equipment to be able to repair it. So there is quite a lot that is involved in radio communications in the state of Oregon beyond just people thinking you can turn your car radio on or just push a button in a police car and start talking to people. There's a lot more to that. And also, interesting today, with our technology currently, there's a computer attached to every radio, or soon will be, if not. And that creates another dimension in the radio communication world. Slide 7 shows commercial power. You see a power line above the snowcat going up to the radio site. Each one of these sites has to have electrical power. Now, that creates a challenge, too. If you have an underground system or a system that's suspended in air that goes to the radio site, as you might suspect, trees fall, wind blows, power poles break off, and you can disrupt the power source and the site can go down. And then in slide 8 and 9, we illustrate how you have to have a backup system. Each one of these radio towers has to have a generator and or a battery backup in case the generator doesn't come on. Now, to give you an illustration of how that worked this last December 3rd in the storm on the northwest coast, there was a radio tower in Clatsop County that lost power early in the storm. The generator, for some reason, did not activate, did not come on, did not start, and so it immediately switched to the battery backup system. And that backup system of battery pack would last 5 to 7 days, giving the radio crew ample time to get to the site to repair it so it could be online. We didn't lose communication in northwest Oregon on the state police and ODOT radio system. All other systems were hampered or completely failed. I also include on slide 10 a picture of Neocony, which is a backbone system, which is a piece of the backbone on the north coast. That tower, compare that to the other towers that you saw. The tower at Neocony is built of wood. That is a substandard tower by today's standards. Does need to be replaced, but that just is an early introduction of some of the towers I'll show you later in the presentation that are owned by the state that need to be brought up to current specifications. I also gave you a map of Oregon. I wanted you to take a look at that and just kind of get in your mind, okay, where do I live? Where have I been in Oregon? Where we have the canyons, the watersheds, the mountains, the hills that could obstruct radio transmissions in the state. Now to the federal mandate. What is occurring is the Federal Communications Commission is requiring that we go from a wideband radio frequency to a narrowband radio frequency. And let me explain why. Today in the United States, as around the world, there is more demand for bandwidth than at any other time, and it's becoming increasingly more. The demand is increasing all the time. I read an article the other day that they project by the end of this year there will be 1.3 billion cell phones in the hands of people. And those cell phones require bandwidth. How many people have been to a high school recently where they change classes, and how many students are walking around looking at a video screen? That even takes up more bandwidth. I mean, that's just the wave of the future. That's happening. And so what's taking place in our society, they want bandwidth. It's a commercial commodity, if you will. So the Federal Communications Commission said, how can we free up more bandwidth so that commercial enterprise and public safety can enjoy the presence of being on the same bandwidth or near the same bandwidth? And that comes through technology. And so this last few years, the Federal Communications Commission passed a law that by 2013, public safety needs to move to a narrow band requirement for their radio communications, which frees up bandwidth to be auctioned off. And in fact, that bandwidth is being auctioned off today. Today was the start of that. All bids had to be in, or all participants who in the bidding process had to have their name in by January 16th. In conversation with people back in Washington, D.C., there are 220 people who are going to bid on the bandwidth that's been freed up by the Federal Communications Commission. A lot of competition. It means a lot of money to a lot of people. And when I was back in D.C. at the 1st of December, I was invited to a banquet honoring the Federal Communications Commission chair. And at that banquet, there were about 3,000 people in the audience. And I learned that the interest in the private sector in this bandwidth sale was at a high pitch. And people in Washington were talking about it continually during my three-day stay as I talked with congressional folks, etc. And one of the things that I'd also asked, I says, now, since this is a federal mandate and you're going to auction this bandwidth off for some unknown amount, I said, would there be any opportunity for any of those dollars to be returned to the state so that we could have some financial assistance from the federal government to upgrade the system in Oregon? And I was told very quickly that there is no program at this time, and no one knew of anything in the near future where monies would be coming to the state to assist with overhauling the state systems. But what's occurring is by going to narrowband at a 12.5 kilohertz, you have to have the new radios, and then you have to have the same radio in the towers, the same radio compatibility in the vehicles and in the handhelds. And that is a fair expense for the state of Oregon. What is going to take place, and I think everyone needs to think a little bit into the future, because we all recognize how quickly technology changes. Now, the Federal Communications Commission has placed in statute that we will be moving to very, very narrow banding in the future. And if we don't go to a digital digital complement to our radio system now, when we go to very narrow banding, you will have to have digital capability in your radio system to be able to talk on that frequency, because you can't communicate via very narrow banding if you're not digital. So I think if we start investing in a digital system today, we'll be setting ourselves up for less expense in the future.
Excuse me, Lindsay, you might mention too the loss of distance on analog when you go to narrow banding.
One of the things that happens, and it's just by the basically law of physics, law of radio waves, however you want to look at it, but when you go from a wide band to narrow band, what takes place is that you lose coverage. Now, in the instance of geographic shapes and distances in the state of Oregon, what does that mean? And there is an industry belief that you might lose 10 to 15% of your coverage if, under the right circumstances, when you go from wideband to narrowband. And when you go to narrowband, to counter that, you have to put up more towers so that it picks up the signal, re-energizes it, puts power back into it again so you can go the distance. That's just one of the things that will plague a narrowband system versus the wideband. You will lose coverage, and you can't get away from it. If you go digital, what takes place is you're basically talking into a computer. The computer reconfigures everything, puts it out for a sound wave or a radio wave, which goes to a tower. The tower picks it up. The computer then once again reconfigures it and moves it across the backbone of the state on the microwave system. Now, if you want more detail than that, we're going to have to go find an electrical engineer. Because it gets very technical very quickly. But in essence, that's how it works.
Representative Edwards has a question.
Mr. Ball, to expand on that, when you go digital, does that require even more towers than going from wide bandwidth to narrow bandwidth? You said that necessitates more towers. So when you go from there to very narrow on this microwave technology digitally, do you need even more towers than that?
If by going from wideband to narrowband, you will need more towers. By going narrowband digital, you should not need more towers.
Than
narrowband.
Okay. Yeah. Thanks.
Excuse me. I think what you're asking is, when we go from wideband to narrowband, it sounds as though we'll need more towers. But if we go digital at the same time, that compensates, and therefore we won't need more towers. Is that correct?
Well, Representative Riley, you will need to have more towers versus wideband. But if you go from, if you're just narrowband and you go to narrowband digital, you should not have to have additional towers just going narrowband to digital.
Okay.
But the difference between wideband to narrowband, you will need to add towers to the state system.
Okay.
The other thing that the computer does too, it can reconstruct the signal. So if it's not an exceptionally strong signal, the computer can be somewhat predictive and reconstructs that message so that it comes out in strong voice quality instead of the scratchy, tail end of a range of a wideband system. That is one thing that digital does do. On slide 13, the FCC mandate, to kind of give you an idea of how serious the federal government is, narrowband by 2013, all frequencies below 512 megahertz, which is 90% of the public safety, PGE, Pacific Power, Light, business industries are all included in that, so they all have to change too. It reduces coverage at about the same cost. Older than 10 years old, systems will be incapable of going wideband to narrowband. On January 11th, or January 1st, 2011, it'll be illegal to sell radios that work in wideband. So the federal law is going to prohibit the sale of those radios as well. And then the impact, why keep reinvesting in a non-digital system? I think that's one of the things that we need to ask ourselves. Is it going to be cost-effective for us to continue an analog system or move directly into a digital system? Knowing that we're going to go from 12.5 bandwidth to a 6.25 bandwidth with no date determined, but knowing that 6.25 will have to be digital, should we invest in digital today or just wait? And I think as we have time to transition, the more time we have, the less impact it will have with it on the state as a cost. The status of Oregon. Currently, we have an aging infrastructure. Our technology is based on 1945, just shortly after World War II. We have analog systems in the state. We are not digital at this time. We have four agencies that have four separate systems that are analog. As I mentioned earlier, we are acquiring used parts to be able to keep the system in operation. We have a limited microwave backbone capacity in the state. If you look at where we are with analog, we can handle 420 voice lines at a time in the state of Oregon. If we just simply go to digital, we can increase that to 2,016 voice lines at a time. In addition to that, analog, which we're currently under, does not have any data capability. Data capability is where you can move things such as pictures of wanted subjects, maps of wildland fires. You can do once and warrant checks from a police car that you can't do today. It will also allow you to be able to transmit information to fire service battalions on a conflagration act that they wouldn't normally have. You can move GIS information, address information, directions to a location via a digital system, and that's data capable. And today we don't have that capability.
Mr. Chair.
Yes, Representative.
Thank you. As you've been immersing yourself in this, where are we in comparison to the rest of the country? I find it hard to believe that we're totally out of line with everybody else. I'm assuming everybody's systems are aging and there haven't been big investments, but am I way off?
Chair Riley, Representative Beyer, I would characterize the state of Oregon as way behind. We have not invested in our communication system in the state. We have, in certain isolated areas, such as the Portland metro area, they have a very robust system. They have digital data capable. They are digital data capable. There are other states that are. Of course, there are states that are not. But when you look at where technology has moved, and we're still resting on the foundation of a 1945 system, I think one can fairly assume that we have a long ways to go to catch up. Now, I'm not saying how to characterize that is we have an opportunity in front of us. It's kind of a wake-up call when the Federal Communications Commission made the mandate. But it's kind of a two-edged sword for Oregon since we haven't maintained our backbone of microwave in the state of Oregon in our radio communications. We've got two issues to deal with. We've got the federal mandate, and then we have the infrastructure in the state of Oregon to upgrade. Now, other states haven't had that problem because they've done a better job of upgrading their systems. But we are in a situation where we're caught both ways. And questions have been asked, well, why haven't we spent money, more money, invested more money in our radio systems? Those questions have come up. There have been a long list of explanations as to why. To give one example, there were choices made in the state police communication system to put and maintain officers on the road and in the field rather than putting money into a communication system. And so I think those kinds of choices have been made. I'm not saying they're bad. I think that's just simply where we are today in the state. And we have an opportunity here to ask ourselves, do we maintain four separate radio systems with forestry, corrections, state police, and ODOT, or do we combine them all into one and then expand from that into a digital trunk system? And I can give you, later in the presentation, I can show you some of the costs other states have experienced by moving to and addressing the federal interoperability mandate, too. To continue with the Oregon status, on slide 15, that shows the coverage that state forestry currently has. They have radio coverage over about 40% of the state. On slide 16, it represents Oregon Department of Transportation coverage, which is about 64% of the state. And then the state police radio sites cover about 75%. If you combine all those into one system using the sites that they have and integrating all four corrections, forestry, state police, and ODOT into one, you'll have 80% coverage across the state of Oregon that all four agencies would then have the capability of engaging in.
Representative Richardson.
There's redundancy currently, and so to just add up the percentages comes up with 80%, but I'm sure there's many towers that overlap, and so will there be a savings if we went to a universal system because we won't need to maintain all of the towers that are currently in place for all four organizations because they would just have to have enough towers, you know, to cover the footprint that we're seeking?
Chair Riley, Representative Richardson, you are correct. There is some overlap currently with some sites. There would be sites that we wouldn't use. But remember, going from wideband to narrowband, we'll have to add sites to maintain the coverage level that we have currently.
What is the percentage, if I could follow up?
Sure.
So far it's been really general. Are we talking about doubling the number, or we have to have twice as much because the span is half as much, or is it 10%? I mean, what are we talking about?
There will have to be 257 radio towers in the state of Oregon to have the 80% coverage. And those are the towers that need to be upgraded and or replaced.
Okay, let's follow up. And the current number of towers that we have?
Chair Riley, Representative Richardson, I can't recall off the top of my head. I'll have to get that information for you. I just don't have that off in my head.
Thank you.
Mm-hmm. Representative Edwards.
Is 80% coverage the goal? Is that?
Or yes. Does? What we agreed to as a goal was not to lose current coverage in the radio system in the state of Oregon. If anything, we would want to enhance the coverage, but minimally, we don't want to lose coverage in the state. And that's how the system was designed, and that's why we have to add towers to the system in order to go from wideband to narrowband in order to have that coverage.
And if I may, the real goal would be 100% coverage, but we know that that's not reachable. Is that?
No, and I think it becomes to you get down to a cost risk factor. How many people have been to Southeast Oregon? And if you spend any time there, there's not a lot of people in some of those areas. And so then you have to ask yourself, is it worth, you know, $25 million to put a leg of a microwave leg in the system in order to cover a very sparsely populated area? Those are value judgments and policy decisions that I think we have to make in the future. But as a rule of thumb, I think our system, radio communication system, has evolved to about 80% coverage. I think that's where we should start. On slide 19, we put it, the number of users and mobiles and portable units that each agency currently has. ODOT has about 3,500 users. Mobiles, they outrank everyone else as well. DOC, people are kind of surprised that Department of Corrections has that many users, but they use radio, push-to-talk radio, inside the walls of all the prisons. And that's how they effectively can communicate as correction officers are on duty inside the prison themselves. Of course, they run three shifts a day, so that ratchets up the number of people that use the radios. And in talking with Wayne Siver and John Kareski, that number at 4,000, it continues to increase as we add prisons. So that's probably an obsolete number today. All total, you're looking at about 10,961 users of radio, of the state radio systems, 5,800 mobiles, 6,800 portables, to kind of give you an idea of the use. On slide 20, I wanted to show you some of the sites that we currently are using in the state of Oregon for state communications. The Columbia County site is a facility that's that uses telephone poles. What happens if that's to get a load of ice and snow on it, which is typical on a mountain site, and you get a hard blow, even 100-mile-an-hour wind, you can snap those poles, those telephone poles off, and you lose your communication site. Curry County site, on slide 21, you can see that the large propane tanks out front that's used to fuel the generator. You see solar panels on top of the tattered roof, and you see a guy-wired tower next to the house. And I'll talk a little bit about guy-wired towers on the next slide. On 22, this is the Union County site. Guy-wire towers are cheaper. They do have maintenance problems associated with them. For instance, if one of those nearby trees was to fall and hit a guy wire and break the guy wire, the tower comes down. Guy wires loosen up. You have to regularly go to the site, test the tension on them. If one loosens up and it starts to tip one way or the other, you can lose a signal. All those things can happen with a guy-wired site versus one that is a standalone three- to four-legged leg tower. What we need in a system is expanded radio coverage, capacity, and redundancy. Trunked digital technologies to enhance public safety capabilities. Data coverage at all Oregon sites. And I think that is where we need to be in the state of Oregon. We need data coverage. I don't want to... it's like this. If we have the capability, the technology today, in many of the municipalities and local governments, we ought to be able to allow that data coverage across Oregon so that you can get pictures of suspects via your data system. You can get the wildland fire mapping via your data system. I think that would prove to be quite an advantage to public safety in the state of Oregon. Expandable standards-based radio and microwave systems, capacity for supporting potential local partners as well as for growth of state agency requirements, and also maintain an open competition in life cycle procurement. And by that, I mean we don't become so specific that we become non-competitive on the open market. I want the open market to be competitive so the state of Oregon can enjoy the product and also a reduced price. Because if we become so specific and there's only one vendor that can supply a product, then we're kind of at the will of that vendor. That's something that we recognize and I've been ratcheting into this process. We're looking at a land mobile radio system. It's the only technology used by all 50 states in their public safety radio systems simply because it's been proven for reliability in emergencies. Used for critical, mission-critical voice and data communications. And in a mission-critical environment, public safety communications must work.
Interrupt?
Yes.
A couple questions. At this point, now you're getting very specific. And ultimately, we're going to talk about money. It's going to be a huge expense. And as a legislature, we certainly would want to assure that we're spending a reasonable amount of money to get the maximum amount of benefit. The focus so far has been solely on connecting our various government entities or those they're utilizing. So I assume that we're talking about ODOT, the four groups currently, Department of Corrections, ODOT, and
OSP,
and what was the
Department of Forestry.
If we're going to spend this kind of money, wouldn't it make sense that we utilize the technology when we're not in a crisis situation? Because we're going to have much more capability than we will utilize most of the time. I have seen nothing about distance learning for schools, medical records transmitted so we can have distant medical. If we're going to have this kind of a system, how are we going to use it to benefit the citizens and not merely have it be there just in case something seriously goes wrong and to conduct normal activities? That's one issue. The second issue I'd like to have you address is what a, you're already going into the type of system it should be in, and how does that, you know, how are we benefiting from what the private sector has learned in its utilization of resources, bandwidth, cost, towers, and so forth, and why do we need to have solely a redundant public sector system if that's what's being proposed?
Did you pay him to do that?
This is no, I haven't talked to him.
Perfect lead-in questions.
Chair Riley, Representative Richardson, very good questions, very good comments about values and risk assessment and cost. Let me roll back to your first was, I think your first comment was, are we looking at a system that is cost effective? Let's take that on first. And I think first and foremost, we need to look at the reliability of the system in conjunction with the cost. And land mobile radio with a microwave backbone, which the state of Oregon currently has proven to be the most reliable and the most cost effective. And let me explain. In order for the radio system to work, you have to have some level of connectivity from site, from tower to tower, to the person keying the mic to talk, pushing that button. Now, you can do that via microwave. You can do that via fiber.
Or satellite.
I
mean, it's not just either or, right? I mean, there's other options.
Right. But let me explain a couple things to rule out some things that people have, a misconception about. Let's take satellite. Satellite is down south of us, near the equator. We don't have satellite capability over the top of Oregon. So you're going to be shooting your antenna at about a 45-degree angle to hit a satellite, roughly.
Especially in the wintertime.
Right. And Oregon is the 45th parallel, so that kind of gives you that angle of reference. What happens is mountains are in the way, buildings are in the way. It's not an effective radio system for the state of Oregon. So that is basically ruled out. Fiber. Everyone talks on their cell phone, and most people are familiar with how their cell phone works for them. And if you've talked on the cell phone much, you also know how it doesn't work for you. And so the reliability there, which is less than acceptable for public safety standards, just does not exist on that type of a system. Putting fiber in from one site to the next, You'd have to run fiber to each mountaintop, which would be extremely expensive. And just simply cost prohibitive. In addition to that, fiber has its own issues associated with reliability. And we saw that in the December 3rd storm that hit the North Coast. There was a landslide and a washout that cut the fiber, and all communication, radio communications at the Emergency Management Center in Clatsop County were lost. The 911 center was down, and was down for several days as they attempted to effect repairs on the fiber. I'm not saying that fiber is bad. It's just there are limitations. But by the same token, the microwave system on the North Coast did stand up to that weather system. It also stood up in Katrina down the Gulf Coast. 911 in New York City, it stood up. It also stood five hurricanes in Florida, as well as the bridge disaster in St. Paul. And the firestorm that they had in Southern California this last fall, they used the microwave digital trunk radio system during that period of time. And so, to get into more detail about cost associated with that, I'd have to go back to the office and get some graphs and charts and things of that nature. But Lend Mobile Radio is the preferred choice by all states in their radio backbone system for public safety.
Can I request an answer to the second part of it then, as far as its
Absolutely.
Utilization? Is this proposed system able to be utilized for distance learning by schools and for distant clinics for medical, distance medical needs and those other things that are developing now?
Chair Riley, Representative Richardson, how I look at this system, the system that was proposed, let me back up just so you can understand how I look at this differently than the first proposal of a new radio system for the state of Oregon. The $665 million that was proposed, it was a proposed cost to build a new radio system for the state of Oregon, was a state-owned, state-operated system, strictly. No partnerships, nothing else. Purely, strictly built for use of state agencies by the state of Oregon only. Now, I think I can pare that I can pare that cost down, and in a little later in the presentation, I can show you what we feel we can reduce the cost in the seven Northwest counties from $139 million down to $97 million just by forming partnerships with people. And I'm not opposed to forming partnerships. Everywhere I've ever been, that's how I've been able to function as I have. Can't do much by myself, I guess. but in addition to that, if you take a look at what we can derive and deliver to the state of Oregon, it's not necessarily cost effective for private enterprise to build out into rural Oregon. But the state of Oregon does have a responsibility to provide security to its citizens through public safety communication, and if we're going to put that system in place, I have no problem letting private enterprise use part of our system, our infrastructure, to get into parts of rural Oregon. I think there's lots of opportunity for partnerships, and quite frankly, when we looked at Northwest Oregon and the seven counties, there is a tower site that's owned by a private vendor that I want to put our equipment on. Conversely, there's a site that we have that the vendor voluntarily came to us here a month or so ago, just shortly after I took over this job. They want to be on our site. And so there's an opportunity there to share a site. Now, as long as we don't erode the public safety system, I have no problem with that. And I think there's and I also think if you want to do a little visioning here today, one of the things I think that we can do here in the state of Oregon is if we allow private vendors and local governments into the system, there'll have to be some type of assessment or lease agreement drawn up. And we haven't gotten there yet. But one of the things that has hampered the state of Oregon and why we're in the situation that we're in today with the status of our system is because we haven't invested any money in it. But if we can come up with some of those lease agreements or assessments, and we dedicate those dollars to a deferred maintenance account to maintain this system, then hopefully we won't find ourselves in a similar situation in the future. And it really comes down: how do you build a public safety communication system to provide security for the people of Oregon? And I think there's some partnerships that we can strike that can benefit the local governments, private enterprise, and the people of Oregon through public safety. It's going to take a lot of work, and there's no two ways about it. If you want to complicate it, something, add more to it. It'd be very simple to just go out and build it ourselves and walk away from it, but I think you lose so much benefit. I would prefer not doing that. And I think we can save some money along the way. And if we're smart about it, then we all huddle up and think about how we might be able to come up with a deferred maintenance account for the system, I think that would do well for the state of Oregon.
Mr. Chair, Mr. Wall, I believe that that's correct. And if we expand the vision beyond just providing the push-button system for our agencies, we may be able to have lease. There could be money coming in if the state provided the structure, the infrastructure to do it, and we were to involve education and medical and other things like that, and there is a reasonable cost to it, then possibly that cost could be in a trust that would go toward maintaining the system in the future, which would certainly help accomplish what you're talking about.
And one of the things that this might be getting way out there, but as long as we're in the vision mode here, and I don't know, and please bear with me. I'm a complete novice in the medical field, but I do know that things like robotic surgery is on the horizon.
It's being done now.
Right, and it's in 10 years it's going to become more and more common. Also, we've been told by young physicians and surgeons they don't want to go to a rural area because they don't have that connection to wise counsel. But if we have an opportunity to where we can exchange information between, I'll just use, I don't know what their status is, so I don't want anybody to point fingers like at Burns, Oregon, but that's rural Oregon. If we can have some kind of a link between Burns, Oregon, and OHSU, where we have a seasoned staff on the faculty that can help a young physician or surgeon in Burns, Oregon, I think that's something that the system might be able to avail itself to.
So this is exactly what I'm talking about, because I recently went through Providence, and they just spent some millions of dollars on a robotic system where the doctor is about 10 feet away from the patient. And they set the patient up, put the probes in, and the surgery is all performed.
Sure.
With his head down, looking at the screen.
And there's no reason it couldn't be 10 miles or 100 miles.
That's right. Absolutely. And so you could have a local clinic that has an emergency situation or even a scheduled situation for surgery that they could set it up, and then the surgery could be performed by a surgeon hundreds of miles away, but you'd like to make sure that the system didn't kind of go down in the middle of the surgery because it could be very inconvenient.
Yes.
And life-threatening. And so this kind of a system would allow itself dramatically, and the cost for medicine, the cost for medical care would diminish dramatically for those kinds of surgeries if we were able to utilize that kind of technology and the system to make that happen, just as one example.
And that's a good, that's an excellent point, and the education one is another piece. We certainly want to put everything on the table here that could utilize this. Education happens to be a little bit of a problem because of our federal information sharing regulations, but it's certainly, we need to look at it.
Well, Mr. Chair, one of the things that I'm trying to promote, as you're probably fully aware, is greater training in Mandarin Chinese for Oregon students. And finding those instructors is a little difficult, but with distance learning, you could find effective, excellent instructors. Yes. And then if you have three kids that would like to take Chinese in Burns or in Glen, what is it, French Glen, mm-hmm. or maybe two there, they would have the opportunity, and they wouldn't be deprived merely because they're rural. So it would be great opportunities if we would be saying, if we have this structure, it's a toolbox, so we know what tools we want in it, but maybe there's many other tools that we could have in this toolbox as well that would benefit our citizens throughout the state.
And I know that the Superintendent of Public Instruction is very anxious to utilize this. I have discussed this with her. So
great. Thank you.
Mr. Chair?
Yes.
I have just a real quick question. The information that we have here, it's looking like not everybody has access to it that's even in this room. Is this anywhere that people can access?
Your PowerPoint?
PowerPoint. Chair Riley, Representative Beyer, no, this is I don't have it anywhere else.
Could you send it to me?
Could you send the PowerPoint presentation,
digitally,
the digital one, to the administrator?
Can we make it available?
Chair Riley, yes, we can.
Thank you.
Thank you.
I don't want to put a damper on the enthusiasm here, because I do want to make sure everyone recognizes it comes with a cost. I mean, this system would cost money. But I also think as we work through this and we evaluate the risks associated with not spending the money and then the risk associated with spending and investing so much money, what are the costs to the cost versus the benefits? And I think we all need to kind of get our heads around that. I feel that if we do this in a very business-like way, we can come up with some good decisions, but we can't. And I will be the person that holds the brake or whatever, however you want to say it. But we don't want to erode the public safety communications system to do something else. We can't do that. That's kind of the main goal here. So, but there's lots of ways we can enhance it, I think.
In other words,
just as an example, if we have a site and the public safety portion of it would take 120 feet of tower, and if we put another 40 feet on the tower, that could be lease space. Those are the kinds of things I think we need to look at in the future, and partnerships can be formed.
Representative Edwards.
So it's safe to say that there are federal standards and mandates about the minimum this system, the minimums for this system, but not necessarily federal regulations that keep us from doing more and partnering and partnering with the medical community and some of these other ideas.
Chair Riley, Representative Edwards, that's exactly right.
Yeah.
The narrow banding requirement is imposed by the federal government. Beyond that, we make our own system. I wanted to give you an idea of what you get what we currently have in an analog system versus a digital system that is proposed to be put in. Currently, in an analog system on page 25, is primarily voice. If you go digital, you can have voice, data, and video. Under analog is unsecured. In other words, you cannot encrypt it. This, I think, is really an issue for law enforcement. They have to be very careful today in any of their voice communications, monitoring by the individuals that you're investigating or you're trying to apprehend. Aids that suspect in avoiding law enforcement. There is no alarm on analog. There is an alarm system under digital. There's currently no data in the state of Oregon analog system. There would be in digital. Loss of quality signal. In digital, it is reconstructive. All agencies are analog, and so consequently, there is no digital. And our analog systems were born in 1945. The digital system was brought online in 1991. It kind of gives you a perspective of where the technology is and where Oregon is. Analog can't talk to digital, but digital can talk to analog. Now, here's another issue that we're facing. There are some local governments that are looking at moving to digital. When they move to digital, we won't be able to talk with them in an interoperable fashion. Benton County is right on the edge of going digital, but if they do, then we are going to be still in our analog phase. Analog does not allow GPS, digital does. There is no priority access under analog, but there is under digital. No emergency button under analog. There is an emergency button under digital. Emergency button is if you're in trouble, whether you're in fire service or law enforcement, you can hit the button, and everyone knows that you are in a bad situation and you need assistance immediately. To kind of give you some cost comparisons on page 26, this gets to the issue of what do we have and what have some of the other states faced. Michigan spent $300 million. Mississippi spent $200 million, recognizing half the size of Oregon. And, I wish we had this problem in Oregon. The highest elevation in Mississippi is only 800 feet. That makes it a dream for radio communications and engineering. Colorado invested $135 million, but they only did it along their major transportation systems. I would not recommend that for Oregon for many reasons. Ohio has a land mobile radio trunk system for $275. It's less than half the size of Oregon. New York spent $2.1 billion. Now, please recognize that cost is spread out over about 20-year time frame. Pennsylvania, $300 million. Florida, $340 million. And Washington is currently in their planning phase. Now, we looked at the Northwest counties, and as we looked at that, we asked ourselves, how can we minimize the cost through partnerships? And how can we minimize the number of sites but reach the state coverage goals that we currently have? And can we use the metro trunking system that's in the Willamette, Multnomah, and
Washington.
No, it's Washington, Multnomah,
Clackamas
County. Their system is very robust. They've invested a lot of money in it. It's up to date. And one of the things we looked at was just simply, can we move into their system, partner with them, so we don't have to build towers. We don't have to put more houses on mountaintops, etc. And we found that the overlay of our coverage needs exactly mirror what the Portland Metro Tri-County system is. And so all we would have to do is put equipment in. We wouldn't have to construct anything. Great cost savings there. On the next slide, I gave you an example of what a loop system is and what is currently being built in the state of Oregon. Now, on this next slide, I showed you the state, the seven northwest counties, and how that loop works from Portland down to Columbia County, over to Clatsop, back to Tillamook, and then on its way back to Portland area. Now, we used the cost associated with federal engineering when they looked at and they evaluated the state and said it's going to cost $665 million. We used that as the foundation. And it would cost, if we build it all ourselves, as was proposed, it costs $139 million. If we form partnerships and use the infrastructure of local governments and private vendors, we can reduce that cost by $42 million, and it would cost us $97 million. And so that's one area I think that we can save money in for the state of Oregon. That's just an example. Now, I want to make sure people recognize, I don't think we can save that margin everywhere in the state. The Portland Metro, the Tri-County area, has a very robust system that we could just move into. Not all counties have that in the state of Oregon. Some are. Some have an up-to-date system. Some don't. But those three counties, just an overlaying our coverage needs, mirrored what their system is. And if we move in, we don't have to build a lot of towers. So we're able to save a lot of money there. You won't see that same percentage savings across the rest of Oregon, I don't believe. And we haven't had time to evaluate any more than the seven counties. So that concludes my presentation. If there are any questions, Chair Riley, I'd sure take those.
Representative Edwards has a question.
So, Lindsay, as we look at this last slide, or the slide that shows the existing loop system, or it says shows existing projects plus adding Northwest counties. So am I understanding the system correctly that where each of these towers is, the loop is how the signals get relayed, and then from each tower you have a radius, a communications radius that's based on line of sight?
Yes.
So, and this is this system what we're talking about for all of Oregon? This is Owen in its totality, or am I not understanding that?
No, this is current configuration.
Current configuration.
Some of which is not completely built yet.
Okay.
So for everyone's point of reference, if you look at the I-5 corridor, go from Portland to Medford, that is what is referred to as IWIN. That's a federal government requirement where they wanted to link the states of Washington, Oregon, and California. We worked out an arrangement with them that they would build the IWIN system down the I-5 corridor, and then they would give that to us so that we would have that system. Now, it's been built to the standard that we would see fit for Owen. The second thing that we did, if you look from Portland, you go up the Columbia River towards Pendleton. That's the Columbia River Intertribal Fisheries Commission backbone. They received a grant from the federal government to put a microwave system in for tribal enforcement of fishery laws on the Columbia River. We heard about that, learned about it. We partnered up with them a year ago, and that system is almost complete now. And that system will revert to state ownership upon completion of that. If you look at the red that comes from the Dalles, from the Dalles down to Bend and then across to Salem, we just received approval or acceptance of our proposal by the Ways and Means Committee last week for the $6 million grant that will put that red loop in. And that would create a loop that goes from Salem to Portland to the Dalles back to Bend. Now, in Northwest Oregon, if you look at the pink, that is the proposed loop that would be for the Northwest seven counties. Now, I want to point out the importance of a loop. If you just think of electricity going in a circle, that's just kind of how I look at it. If you break that loop someplace, and then you're pushing your electricity in one direction, what happens automatically in the equipment is that everything's just reversed automatically. I mean, it happens so quickly under the system that you don't even notice hardly any disruption in communications at all. If you just have a straight leg that comes off without a loop, if you cut that leg someplace, you're done. So in your system, as you build it, you want to look for that loop opportunity so that you can reverse directions immediately. The same thing works with fiber as it does microwave. And that's one of the reasons that Clatsop County had trouble in the storm, was because they're on a leg system of fiber. You cut the fiber and they're down. You know, another interesting thing we learned last week, Senator Johnson got a hold of me while I was here testifying on the COPS grant, and she'd been notified that they lost the 911 center down in Clatsop. And so they started trying to, they started tracing down what had happened, and what occurred was there was a break in the fiber system between Longview and Kelso, Washington. And as I understand it, and I haven't got this verified, but I understand that there was vandalism and the 1,000 feet of fiber was stolen. And so the system went down. So there, those are some of the things that, that are associated with fiber that, that does not produce the reliability that one might want. But if you had a loop system of fiber, then it would just reverse itself immediately, and you'd, you'd still be in operation.
Yes.
Is there security at each tower, or somebody that lives there, or 24 hours, or?
No. A very Representative Riley, Representative Edwards, are very, very few sites where anyone might be in the close vicinity. Sometimes that's the case, but in your high mountain sites, no. So you have to build. You have to construct a building that is basically bulletproof because vandals do have a tendency to want to shoot up a system. Don't ask me why. That's people. And so you have to take all that into consideration as you construct a site and establish a perimeter around that site. There are sites at a lower elevation that are in people's backyards or on their property someplace that people have a tendency to watch over more, and that's not a problem. But a lot of your high mountain sites are on public land, mm-hmm. and so people can access them by going up the road. And a lot of those roads are gated where they go to the site, but you can still walk up to them. And they're at high points. People like to get to a high point to look across the vista, so... Yeah, there's a risk of vandalism at these sites.
Other questions? Thank you very much, Lindsay. I appreciate you coming and sharing this with us.
Well, I certainly appreciate everyone's interest.
Just a final comment that because this is such a large amount of money, I would think that the more that can be done to show its versatility, the better it will be acceptable to have to swallow such a bitter pill financially.
Well, I think it's going to take longer, I think, as you walk through, you know, creating partnerships with local governments and private vendors. It always does, and there's always kind of different complexities that come out of that. But I still say the benefits outweigh the effort.
Just the design is the issue. It's not finalizing deals. It's making it available so that you have that ability to expand to even areas that we may not even know about now, but a few years from now could be done. And also there's the ecological aspect of building towers in places where there needs to be cell phone coverage that isn't there now or it's not very good, where we could lease space to private enterprise that's providing cell phone coverage, because then you don't have to have multiple towers, which is kind of a visual issue as well as ecologically.
Yeah, and as capacity demand increases for the use of cell phones, you're going to have to put up more and more towers. So. You know, one of the things that I think probably should briefly explain, I've had a lot of people talk to me about, well, we'll just put up more cell towers, and then you can just use a cell phone system for communication. But if you think about line of sight, if you think about communications on most of our transportation systems, principally our highways, they're at the bottom of a canyon following a river or stream, and you would have to build, I don't have any idea how many towers, because at each turn, if you lose line of sight with a tower, you have to have another tower to be able to pick your signal up to be able to communicate. And I think our mountain passes and watersheds and the transportation system, you'd have to have hundreds of towers to be able to accommodate that type of a system. And it'd be very expensive.
Well, it's clear that a lot of thought is going into this, and multiple groups looking at it, and that's not always good, but sometimes it is. I think in this case, the more people who have input to what we're going to eventually come up with, the better. So, again, thank you very much for your presentation.
Thank you.
And what do we have next? Okay. So now we're gonna hear about from the Office of Regulatory Streamlining, Kara Felsinger. And she's going to tell us about plain language.
Good morning, Mr. Chair. I've cleared the room. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I'm Kara Felsinger. I'm the acting manager of the Office of Regulatory Streamlining in the Department of Consumer and Business Services. Thank you for the invitation to talk about the chair's favorite bill from session, I think, maybe. House Bill 2702, the plain language bill. I was asked to provide just a brief update today, and this is the best time to testify, I know, is right before the lunch hour. So I will be brief today. And Ms. Taylor, your staff provided you a copy of our implementation plan. It's got a state seal on it. It's written in pretty plain language. We tried very hard to do that. As this committee is aware, House Bill 2702 required development of a plan to implement the plain language standard in state agencies. And the governor appointed DCBS, Department of Consumer and Business Services, as the lead, and my office as main responsibility for coordinating the plan implementation. Although we're the lead agency, I will tell you that I had a lot of help and a lot of interest from many state agencies on this. I got a lot of input, and there are truly... there are state agencies who are enthusiastic about plain language. So it might be hard to believe, but they really are, and I appreciated their help very much putting this plan together. It wouldn't have come together without their help and interest. So I'm going to hit some of the highlights from the plan and some of the things that we've done since November and give you a preview for what you'll see in the report on February 1st. Because the law applies to every agency, from the very smallest regulatory agency with two people to the biggest agency with, you know, Department of Human Services with hundreds of employees, we tried to structure the plan so that they had the best opportunity for success while using an agency's existing resources. So big agencies have communication staff and professional communications folks to help them. Smaller agencies don't necessarily have those resources. So we tried to cover the bases, and that's that was a challenge for us. The plan first focuses on general public documents, those kinds of things that an average Oregonian might actually get in their mailbox or pick up from a state agency, brochures, informational pamphlets, and the dreaded form letter that we have a lot of form letters in state government. So agencies were encouraged to focus first on those things that touch the average Oregonian and folks who have probably the most frustration with documents from government. And we've encouraged them as they start to revise them or update them in any way, especially after session, which is a time that those things happen. We've encouraged them to start doing plain language. The legislature defined what plain language means. Start applying it to your documents now. So we've kind of put together a phased-in plan, and the title of the plan is Preliminary Plan. We see this as a evolving process, and we want to make sure that we are reasonable and also learn from the opportunities and challenges that implementation sometimes has. So what we've done is a two-phase plan, and we're in the process of phase one. We've done, I would say, most of phase one is complete or at least in progress. And some of the things we've done, we've provided state agencies some tools to get them started. We put together a quick card, one page, sort of easy tips for doing plain language document that was distributed to all state agencies, so, and posted on our website as well. We've developed a website with resources to tips and links and writing tools. It links to the Washington State model. They have an excellent website with a lot of good, helpful information for state agencies folks to use. So we're trying to build on the things that are people have already done. Federal government, surprisingly, has an excellent plain language website. So we've tried to combine, make a little hub of information for state employees. We have developed and started a plain language pilot training program, and we've also started a wide variety of pilot projects with some agencies. And I'm going to talk about a couple of those things real quickly, just by way of highlights. I want to thank two state agencies specifically because they volunteered to take on implementation of two big parts of our plan. The Department of Administrative Services developed the pilot training program through their statewide training and development program. It's an affordable class. It's a half day. I think it's $35 to attend, which is pretty reasonable for training. And today, at this moment, the very first class is underway, and I'm excited to see how it goes. So they've started the pilot training classes. As of late last week, we'd filled over 80% of the first group of classes, and I suspect it will be full by the end of next week. So there is a lot of interest in plain language. Agencies are excited about it. I got an email requesting some Coos Bay on-site training this week. So we've got folks who are excited to learn about plain language. So I wanted to thank DAS for doing that for us. We really appreciate it.
Excuse me.
Yes.
Representative Edwards has a question.
Will local governments be able to participate in this type of training if they're right. interested?
Mr. Chair, Representative Edwards, that's an excellent question. I need to ask DAS about that. Currently, it's set up for state employees because this particular bill applies to state government. I suspect there will be a lot of local government interest in it as well, but I can ask them about that.
Okay. And could you notify the administrator about your answer to
Sure, me? Absolutely. I also wanted to thank the Oregon State Library. They took on the task of developing the website hub, and they've developed and are hosting and managing the site, which is plainlanguage.oregon.gov, easy to find, plain language name. We appreciate them taking the task on. They saw that as befitting their role as servicing state agencies and supporting them, so we're pleased to have them participate. We have six agencies conducting pilot projects, and I want to thank them publicly because it takes something to volunteer to do this, and these are the folks that are actually really excited about participating. The Department of Revenue, the Employment Department, Department of Environmental Quality, Department of Administrative Services, the Office of Private Health Partnerships, and the Department of Consumer and Business Services, my agency. So thank you to those six pilot agencies who have volunteered their services.
Will you, in your February report, will you be giving us examples of what they're doing?
Yes, Mr. Chair, thank you for that question. Yes, we will have some examples ready. We've tried to, there are some long-term and short-term projects going on. We're going to try to include some of the short-term examples so you have something to look at.
Thank you.
And actually, that's a good segue into my next discussion. We are trying to do some pilot projects, small projects, things like form letters, things that don't take a lot of time to see how easy it is to do, apply the plain language standard. There are also some really long-term projects going on. In particular, the Employment Department is rewriting their unemployment claimant handbook, which goes out to over 200,000 Oregonians every year. It's a huge document explaining your rights and responsibilities as an unemployment recipient. I'm pleased they have decided to take that on as their challenge. I certainly don't understand unemployment insurance, so I'll be interested to see how they do it. So we're trying to they kind of cover the wide range of projects and seeing where the successes and opportunities lie in those kinds of things. We are trying to do pilot projects that have measurable impact or trying to measure impact. Those are more difficult, as you might imagine, to arrange. We do have one at the Department of Consumer and Business Services. It's a collections letter that we get a lot of phone calls on. I don't understand this. I don't know what you're asking me to do. Mm-hmm. We did rewrite it, and I personally think it's very well done. We're going to see how many phone calls we get after we start using the new letter. So we're trying to do that, and the legislation asked us to focus on that as well. And we will be using these examples to help show state agencies how you can do this. You can do it. It's actually, I think it's fun to try to convert something that's complex into something that's more simple. And we're going to use these pilot projects as training tools and examples for state agencies to learn from. And the State Library will have all of those on the web page as they're done. So we will have kind of a central location for those. And again, the reason for the first phase is sort of learn from what we've challenges. I think there are some challenges that we probably face implementing the plain language standard. But we have a lot of opportunities. I think we need to find out where those fruitful areas for effort might be and inform kind of the second phase of the project. And that's where we will kind of analyze how the pilot projects are going, analyze how the training was received and whether or not we need to do some adjustments, and make some recommendations about other areas we may want to focus on, where agencies can and should apply their effort. So we're going to report on those activities too in 2009. That was part of the legislation, and we're happy to do that. House Bill 2702 really highlighted plain language as an important thing, and people are talking about it. And Chair Riley, yesterday during your Consumer Protection Committee meeting, you heard about an example of just that. The Mortgage Lending Work Group is putting forward some recommendations to the special session, and one of their ideas is a consumer notice. And they actually applied plain language, and they tried very hard. And they started getting a little technical. They'd come back and say, how do we say this plainly? So while immediate tangible results might not necessarily be showing themselves, I can tell you that people are thinking about it. State agencies want to communicate clearly. They really do. And passing your bill really helped put the focus on it and provided some guidelines about what it is you expect written communications to look like. So we look forward to talking with you more about this in the future, and I would be happy to answer any questions.
Questions? I'm sitting here just about to bring up the plain language website.
Mr. Chair, that's the hazard of letting you have computers in the hearing room.
Plainlanguage.oregon.gov.
Plain language, all together, one word.
There you go.
Plain language.
There it is.
.gov. Now, this is probably the federal one.
Oh, U.S. So it's plain language. Oh, you've got
Oregon.
Oregon.
Yeah. But I did get the federal one. I'll look at the other one later.
Okay.
But that's great. And I really thank you for your presentation and this preliminary plan. I'm looking forward to actually seeing the fruits of the bill come forward. I think it's, you know, we're going to make a big impact on how the public sees its government at work, and I think that's really important. So thank you very much. Thank you very much. I appreciate it. So with that, I'm going to close this informational hearing, and I'm going to open a work session and on LC 71. Representative Edwards.
I move that we request LC 71 be introduced as a committee bill during the February 2008 session.
Representative Edwards has moved that we request LC 71 be introduced as a committee bill during the February 2008 session. Is there any discussion?
I just have a question.
Yes.
We were trying to maybe duplicate our efforts from last session where we overwhelmingly passed Senate Bill 1039. Mm-hmm. It was subsequently vetoed. Why are we not trying to look at just overriding the veto? And I notice there's quite a bit of difference between this LC and the bill that we passed last session. It's a lot, well, for lack of a better term, it's weaker. And I'm just wondering why we're not looking at just trying to get the original bill that we passed last session back through.
Two answers to that. Number one, as a committee, we don't have that option. That would be...
Correct. That would be a function of the... But I'm just wondering, have there been any discussions around the entire, you know, House and Senate overriding the veto?
Okay. Not that I'm aware of. Okay. The reason we're doing it this way as a committee bill is, frankly, because you asked for it.
Well, definitely. But
there are quite a few differences
between the original bill.
I didn't know that there were going to be differences, honestly. This is the LC draft that came forward. It's not necessarily the final bill.
Gotcha. Yeah.
As you know, LC drafts don't always end up being exactly the final bill that comes out. So,
Mr. Chair,
Richardson,
it'd be interesting. I didn't think of doing this earlier, but it would be interesting to know why the drafter chose to change the language so dramatically in its key areas,
yes,
to where it was designed to actually focus on implementing ways to be more efficient in agencies, and now it's may advise with respect to performance improvement efforts and training for state managers, and I mean it's been diluted substantially, and I don't think that was an accident.
It's my belief that this came about. The Senate is introducing this bill as well. And it's my belief that that came about in negotiations with the senator and the governor. That's my belief.
Mm-hmm.
I was not involved in those negotiations, but I think that's probably how that came about. And that's the best answer I have for you.
The risk is getting to a point where it looks like we're doing something, but in reality, we're not. You know,
and we certainly don't want to do that.
Because I mean, if it's a political decision so that the legislature can leave here saying, "By golly, we've established a committee on performance," but when you read the material, what it actually does is actually very little other than it creates a new committee that will give some advice to leaders of agencies that they may either accept or not accept, but it really doesn't go nearly as far as actually evaluating what they're doing and being a kind of an external source of information and improvement for improving the way things are done. Then we really haven't done anything. We just look like we've done something, and I think that's a real risk in the wording. Would we have time that we could ask LC to come up here?
No, they're.
Oh, that's right. They're not up
away.
Here.
They're 15
they're not
minutes
here.
Away.
That's right. So I guess ultimately the decision is: do we go ahead and go forward with the idea that at least it's something, and then it depends on who's on the committee as to whether or not they actually accomplish anything, or are we wasting the people's time and money by proposing a bill that is so diluted that it no longer accomplishes what we had intended?
Let me answer that in two ways, if I may. Number one, I think we should go forward and because, you know, if we don't go forward now, this just dies. The second part of that answer is there will be opportunity for amendments to this bill. And I think that that's where we can look at, you know, maybe bringing it back closer to what it was. I'm not sure how it'll come out. But as you know, as we all know, LC drafts and even the final bill that comes to the committee is not the final bill always. And there are always opportunities in committee for amendment.
That sounds reasonable.
Okay.
I agree with you, Mr. Chair.
Yes.
I guess in my way of thinking that if we didn't look at this bill and didn't try to address some of the concerns the governor had, we're still going to be in the same situation we were at the end of last session where the governor vetoes the bill. And so any effort we can make to try to address those concerns, I think, would be greatly appreciated on my part. Because once you get into the political veto issue, it's not a fun place to go, and it doesn't make for good policy, I don't think.
Thank you. Any other? Well, we do have a motion before us, and is there any objection to that motion? In that case, the motion carries, and I believe that's all we have on our plate today. Thank you, everyone, for coming, and thank you for staying.
Dana's going to be
not
during session.
Yeah.
That's Dana Richards.
Yeah. So, and by the way, if you could come talk to me afterward. I'm going to close this meeting today, and thank you all very much.